In today's quest, we meet the other half of the power couple that shaped France. She is the mother of the Merovingian dynasty. This is Clotilda, and this is A Quest for Power. Welcome back to The Quest for Power, where we are ranking and reviewing all of the European monarchs from the early Middle Ages to World War I. We are Scott and Michael, and we are leading you through the history of the Merovingian dynasty. And we are on, I believe, episode number 3 of the Merovingian dynasty.
Maybe that is correct. There.
and we have a couple firsts. So first, we're rating our first queen consort, not necessarily our first queen. Right. And then
correct.
Or we're rating our first saint, because she is a saint, Saint Clotilda.
There's one thing I have to say on that. Apparently, there Clovis at one point was made a saint, but the Catholic Church looked at his other past deeds and went, No. We're not stooping that low.
Yeah, we're here to we gotta save face a little bit.
Yeah.
So now that we've kind of whetted your appetite a little bit on what we've got coming up, we're going to tell you how you can continue on to your to keep your appetite up for keeping up with us on Facebook and Instagram at Quest for Power Pod, or email us at questforpowerpod@gmail.com. And we've mentioned this before, and if you're looking for some extra content and want to continue to support us, we're building a library of extra content at patreon.com/questforpower. So, all right. Now that we've established who we are, why we're here, let's meander our way. We'll find a nice, lovely segue into the meat and potatoes here. So what's been going on, Michael?
Well, recently we did the D&D campaign, which was we had a pretty wild session where we kept like having the Star Wars worlds within worlds by traveling to the different planes, or at least we could have with your little door you created.
Yeah, like the I basically, for people who are not sitting at the table with us, is I created a means of interplanar travel, which is to say that there's all these different worlds in the Dungeons and Dragons universe, and I basically created one place where you can portal or walk to other planes of existence. And these other planes are like the Feywild, which is where fairies live, and then you have these elemental planes like the plane of fire, water, air, earth. And so the party found this and they kind of started fiddling with it and realizing, oh shoot, we can go anywhere. And that's kind of what the party did most of the time, which is, I think it's great. It was great for them. Like, I think it was also part of it because I didn't explain the quote unquote puzzle as well as I could have. But the end result was still really fun. The party still found their way to the correct door, correct gate they were supposed to take. So it all worked out nicely in the end. And I'm excited for next time, because they're about to find a big legendary artifact and try and keep it away from the bad guys.
And you left us on one hell of a cliffhanger that we had two little tiny vampires following us for quite some time.
That's right.
We need to teach some lessons.
Yeah.
Here's a segue. Speaking of teaching lessons, let's get on to sources.
Yeah.
Smooth.
Yeah.
All right. So there is no primary source that focuses strictly on Clotilda, like of contemporary times. Gregory of Tours wrote about her, but it was years after her death, and he was using primary sources that have been lost to history. All right. Quick note. I know I have been bashing Gregory of Tours, and it's a really fun pastime, but as I'm learning more about him, it looks like he actually was trying to tell the truth. I'm learning more that he actually was using his own sources and cross-referencing them like an actual, like a historian. It was like the first thing, like, yes, he has his own agenda, but his sources also had their own agenda. And remember the kind of stuff they believed back then. So he may have believed some of the stuff that he says that were like, that's nonsense.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of nice when you have your biased sources be fact checked. Like, yes, you're technically correct, which is the best kind of correct, but you're still well, either cherry picking or rephrasing things, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's essentially what we do. we rephrase things.
I wonder, what's our agenda? Viewership.
Yes. And I like stories. They're fun. I've always been curious on the different stories that we've never heard of. I haven't heard of most of our kings before I read that they're the next king up.
Well, so, you know, it's not like a thing that they taught us a lot of in school.
Yeah, but speaking of, again, teaching, what did we learn previously on the quest for power?
Entrapment. It's horrible. That's like my one word summary for like the last episode. So the reason I say it is because we had our lovely friend Clovis the First. He the First, yeah. So
yes,
he's really wonderful, clever, conniving, basically was tricking people into betraying their own people, and then he instantly punishes them for being traitors. He did that at least two or three times.
Yes, he did. He masterful. Absolutely beautiful on a strategic level.
Yeah, it's just really it's a certain level of just comic. It's so comical.
Yeah.
That he'll be like, "Hey, go betray your ruler or your buddy." And then they go do it and they go, "Okay, you know, like a well-trained dog, they come back expecting their treat." And then he goes, "Only, you know, the only treat you're getting is my blade down your throat." And you know, that goes on for a couple times and goes to has some conflict against we've got at least a couple. We had our friends with the Visigoths, with Alaric the Second, and Alaric the Second. The bad Alaric. And then we had the two kings.
Are you talking about Burgundia?
Yes, I may have been.
Oh, so Gundobad and
Gundobad
and who I figured out is Gadizel. So there
Gadizel.
We go.
I was pronouncing the extra G, which is apparently silent because apparently we just have to throw in extra letters. Yeah, it's cool.
Of course.
So I've already forgotten how to say his name. Gadizel. Okay. So he kind of like pitted the brothers, or not brothers, oh my god. He pitted them against each other. And then there was kind of this odd like falling out of agreements. And that's all I really remember, honestly. And that he died relatively peacefully, and that he is, you know, just one of the great founding members of the Merovingian dynasty, and then of course, you know, shaping modern day France. All that good stuff.
It's pretty good. You've missed one pretty big thing. His conversion to Christianity. It's pretty much what he's known for.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, to me, it just feels like so obvious. But yeah. It's one of those things where I'm like, oh yeah, you know, of course they're Catholic. Or, you know, Nicene at the time.
Yes. Yeah, can't have that Catholic Arianism crap around here.
Yeah, probably just use the words interchangeably between Catholic and Nicene because they kind of just go together after a while.
Actually, I think now it's Chalcedonian, so that's a new one. So I think there is on Useful Charts, their YouTube, I saw that they have one based on like the Catholicism like tree, so how it got to there.
So when did we start calling it Catholicism?
Okay, so how it starts out is we have the Great Church, which then branches off into Nicene Christianity in 431. There is a Council of Chalcedon in 451, which will then lead to someday the Roman Catholic Church, which happens during the Great Schism of 1054.
Okay.
There you go. The more you know. I would highly suggest check out the chart. It's actually really fascinating. It's kind of funny when you see Arian Christianity. It has a little bottom to the ends and just does extinct. So we see that they won out in history.
Jesus being a separate dude, no bueno.
I forgot. I heard one time the church saying like, oh, God's first, Jesus is second, and the Holy Spirit's third. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You killed people over that. What do you mean? That aren't they all the same thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, they're the only victors in that sphere. So I think they get to write the rules.
I mean, yeah, that is true. That's most of our stuff on this. Anyway, so before we begin, as we said, we are doing the first queen consort. And I don't know about you, but I think it would be absolutely ridiculous to rank them on the same scale as, you know, regents. It would be like the Super Bowl team facing the college championship team. Yes, both play football, but they're not even close to the same league.
Difference being is that one was probably intentionally handicapped.
Yeah. So for non-regents, we need to determine if they are powerful enough and famous enough, religious enough, and they leave a lasting legacy to become the hand of the king, or are they mediocre and we don't really like them and they get kicked out of the king's council, or are they so pathetic that they just need to be exiled out of the kingdom altogether? So they avoid the stake, but I figure that, you know, kings should have higher stakes. You know, you should be burned alive if you're that bad instead of just exiled.
We're much kinder than the actual Europeans at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the time you would just get your, it would be beheading, but Battle Royale beheads the kings that they don't like. So, or not that they don't like, that they don't deem worthy enough. So we're not going to cross into that territory. We are looking at the thing we've always been looking. How do they acquire power and how do they use it? And how basically medieval enough are you? Or, you know, European enough?
Wonderful.
The times. Are you the quintessential of what the ruler is at the time? So, okay. like Alaric, all the way back, I think it's over a year ago. We've been doing this for a year. I don't know if you've realized that.
Yeah.
Clotilda is going to set the standard for the non-regents. Alrighty. So now on to the main quest. You are in the presence of Her Highness, St. Clotilda of House Burgundy, the first of her name, the Pious, Queen Consort of the Salian Franks, Queen Consort of the Ripuarian Franks, Queen Consort of all the Franks. She basically inherits most of Clovis's titles when she gets married. We'll talk about that pretty quickly. And
fair enough.
First of all, she was born as a Burgundian princess, hence House of Burgundy, and she is the daughter of Kilprick II of Burgundy and his unnamed wife, because, you know, God forbid we know any of these queens' names. It's kind of nice we know Clotilda's. Clotilda did have a sister named Chroma, and that's what we know. I think Chroma goes on to become some sort of nun. Yeah, that's what it is. She becomes some sort of nun. Mm. And that's all we know the rest of her. Clotilda, later described, is having a reputation of pretty much being the perfect medieval woman. She had wit, she was beautiful, she was meek, she was modest, she was obedient, she was pious. Everything a king would want.
Yeah. Well, this was also the same person that, like, you know, we talked about last time that Clovis, like, apparently described to her, someone described her to Clovis, and he was like, I gotta have her.
Yeah. Yep.
Bring her here. And she's like, see a family or king that I don't want to be around.
Yeah.
So yeah. Sounds like a perfect match.
I fully agree, except for, well, we'll get into that.
All right, fair enough.
Kilprick ruled Burgundy jointly with his father because, you know, got these guys all do nuts things before the kingdom was broken into four parts because God forbid you leave the kingdom together and do primogeniture after his father's death. And so he and the three of his brothers all inherit a piece of Burgundy. So this is going to go really well, right? When you split a kingdom up.
Every time.
So while Clotilda was an infant, Kildeprick's brother Gundobad assassinated Kildeprick and threw his wife into a well where she met a horrible fate by drowning. He then exiled the two princesses. What the hell was the problem with the wife? Like, what's with the well? That's completely unnecessary.
Yeah, I don't know. It sounds pretty par for the course at this point.
It does, but oof. That one, little much throwing them down the well.
All's well that ends in the well.
That's going to come back to bite Gundobad in the future. A little foreshadowing there.
Yeah.
Clotilda and her sister were taken in by their uncle Gadizel, or God G as we called him last episode because I couldn't figure it out, and his court is in Geneva. As we discussed earlier, Clovis heard amazing reports of Clotilda. Dude, she is the perfect woman. And so he basically forced Gundobad to let him marry her, which Gundobad accepted. What I'm confused by this is Clovis had to get permission from Gundobad. And every source says she was exiled out of the kingdom and she took refuge in Gadizel's kingdom. Why would he have to get Gundobad's permission, who was her parents' murderer? Is it because they were allies or something?
Yeah, maybe, or that, like, he just didn't necessarily want to get... either piss off Gundobad and, you know, she shows up one day and he's like, hey, hold up a moment. Didn't I like exile you? And then also it could have also been from Clovis's part being like power play, like, hey, like, or maybe not power play, but like a respect move / power play. Like, hey, you're going to let me marry this person that technically is kind of, you know, under you, I guess. I don't know. It's
I would have to go more with that. I do not think Clovis was afraid of Gundobad.
No. Yeah, it just feels like like I'm going to interface with you as, you know, from a king to fellow king kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like we're going to do this at a royal level, and that way, like, you know, cuz it's different from being like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to marry this person that just, you know, to you probably doesn't matter," to like, "Oh, hey, you know, I'm going to like force a confirmation from you."
Yeah, it could have been a power move to really be like, you can say no, but you're probably not going to like the consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm just going to take this opportunity to do it. Not sure what how that goes down. None of it makes sense to me. So,
okay. So I'm glad I'm not the only one who's a little lost. Yeah.
I'm doing mental gymnastics here.
So at this time, Clovis was a filthy pagan, you know, he worshipped idols that didn't work. And but Clotilda, at the time that he asked for her hand in marriage, she demanded the right to practice her faith, Christianity, completely. And like a good future husband, Clovis acquiesced to her wishes. The strong, manly king that has bloodlust is like, yeah, you know what? You can have your religion, which is kind of interesting. But I guess he was also in good, like, terms with the bishops. So maybe that was, you know, yeah. I'm very nice to Catholics. I married one, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Plus, like, I don't know, pagans are a lot more loose with, you know, having other people follow a different faith.
Yeah, in fact, when Christianity,
by comparison,
when Christianity first came around, they're like, oh, just so you know, Jupiter, yeah, just put a sprig out for him. I don't really care if you really believe that or not. And yeah, we'll throw in Jesus on the pantheon if that's what you want. And in fact, sometimes Jupiter and Jesus got mixed up together while Christianity and paganism was coming together.
What would Jupiter do?
There you go. That should be on
a t-shirt.
You don't
want to know what Jupiter would do.
especially if Jupiter is the exact personification of Zeus.
That's
fully agree.
How I always understood it, is that Jupiter was the crossover,
yeah,
from Zeus, and probably inherited a lot of his personality.
I would love to actually dive into more of Roman mythology and like figure out like what were the differences between the Greeks and Romans, because the Romans basically stole everything from Greece and then said, this is mine now. But like, what things did they add
or take away, more importantly?
Yeah,
so fun stuff. Next.
in 492 or 493, we don't know the exact date, she married Clovis and Soissons and inherited all of his royal titles, as I said in the beginning. That's just the way it worked. The queen consorts would inherit the royal titles, but according to Salic law, when they would die, they would lose all those titles. And that was Clovis who put that law like into stone. So kind of interesting. But at the same time, I want to know what the ceremony was that like. Like, was it Christian? Was it a Christian, you know, ceremony? Or was it a pagan ceremony? I feel like Clovis would not like, he's the man in the relationship at this time. And he's a bloodthirsty warrior. There's no way he would allow like the even thought of people that look that like a woman is controlling him. And by the sounds of it, there's no way in hell, no pun intended, that she would do a pagan ceremony.
Yeah, it's probably like it's like got a lot of the Christian like fixins, but with like a pagan vibe.
I could see that. Okay, yeah, that'd be interesting. Because like, yeah,
you just make the marriage look very like, I don't know, forced. Because in reality, it kind of probably was anyways.
Yeah, it probably was.
He just happened to respect his wife more than a lot of other medieval royalty.
Yeah, he respected her quite a bit. After she became queen, Clotilda actually had a little chapel created in the royal palace, and she spent most of her time there in prayer, it is said. It's also said that she actually had to hide how devoted she was to her faith in order to fully execute her role in court. I'm sure that's Gregory just really playing her up.
Yeah.
It is said that she executed all of her courtly duties with dignity, order, piety, and charmed the king and his court. Again, the perfect medieval queen. But I also like where it says she charmed the king and his court. And that's like, to me, this really cutthroat king looking at his wife like, aw, it's so cute the way she does that. You know, like she's charming the way her customs are or things like that.
Yeah. From the record we have here, it very much sounds like he's just totally smitten with her. Right.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's the way it is, but the way this is written, it reminds me of the Game of Thrones relationship between Khal and Khaleesi. A lot of people who watch Game of Thrones will know this one. After their marriage was actually good. We don't need to talk about the first part. Well, the first part happened, but after they had like a good relationship is what it reminded me. This big, tough, you know, ruler who kills people without thinking about it, and then, you know, is really kind and actually thinks highly of his wife, which is kind of nice during this time period. It is said that her charity to the poor was like a sea that could never be drained. She was obedient, like you said, to her king and husband. She used her charms to sweeten his warlike temper, made herself laugh at his jokes, which she didn't really care for, and she knew how to make the king happy and was the mistress of his heart. How sweet.
The ultimate power couple right there.
Absolutely. And this is a clear embellishment, but a lot of the research on Clotilda and Clovis is that Clovis, actually, from everything I've ever seen, he actually seems to have had a soft spot for her, despite being an absolutely vicious, violent, cutthroat king that, you know, entrapment was his favorite thing to do. He had no moral bone in his body, but she must have made him happy because he seemed to do a lot of things for her.
Yeah.
Classic Beauty and the Beast.
She seems like a fairly shrewd person too. So a person who you're like, you can have your chapel, you can do your piety, and you know, you're not gonna create as big of a stink when it comes to, like, you know, differing policies, what have you.
Yeah. If she's even allowed to be in the rooms during those are being made.
Clovis has got his deal and she's got hers.
Well, actually, I think she would be in the room because she had to run the kingdom while he was off to war.
Oh, yeah.
Also, it doesn't really show mostly in the narrative, but she is one of many of Clovis's wives. The church just does a really great job of trying to pretend that that's not a thing.
That it's monogamous.
That it's monogamous. It's not even close to monogamous. Well, he had plenty of concubines. He had other wives. The church says that he repudiated other wives, and maybe he did when he actually converted, as we discussed last episode. But the later Merovingian kings are going to have tons of wives and concubines, so that tells me he did not.
They're probably like, well, this is the only real marriage. All of the rest of them were pagan marriages and don't count.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Well, the two liked each other enough that Clotilda became pregnant, and she bore a son named Ignomer. She baptized him behind Clovis's back. Not very good, not very obedient, and unfortunately, Ignomer died shortly after birth. That was Clovis's, one of his heirs. Must have made him fly off the handle, be like, what did I tell you? You baptized him and you killed our son, which, that would feel horrible for Clotilda, especially when something like that would be said. I don't know if he actually said that, but come on.
The conversation had to have been there. It's a wonder he converted at all.
Exactly. Yeah. And it wasn't long, though, that they tried again. And Clotilda became pregnant. And she once again gave birth to a healthy baby boy named Clodomer. And despite the fate of her first son, Clotilda's faith did not waver. And she baptized Clodomer behind his back again.
Yeesh.
And shortly after baptism, Clodomer felt deathly ill. So as you can imagine to Clovis, this was another heir dying to his wife's stubbornness, and that would have drove him nuts. I can't imagine the marriage was really good at this point.
Yeah, what's up with their water? This is really like the Family Guy episode where they tainted holy water. Stewie gets sick because the Pope didn't wash his hands after going to the bathroom and then blessing the holy water.
Tainted
holy water.
I never even thought of that, and I bet you I wrote this story off as it didn't happen, but that could be that, like, he died from, you know, because it's not like an infant has the best immune system, that he swallowed some of the water when he was being baptized, because they didn't do what they do now, where they just dump it on their head. They freaking dunked him all the way in. And so he probably swallowed a little bit of it, and he got sick from the water.
Yeah. I mean, it also could just be that they're bad luck people, you know. Infants got sick all the time back then, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Just that they're two for two. And that's, yeah, I can't believe that this happened twice.
So while he is, Clodomir is very, very sick, and Clotilda prayed day and night for the recovery of her son and for her husband to convert. But Clovis was not, you know, in the mood to convert, as you can imagine. Eventually, though, her son started to recover, and he avoided death. So one of her prayers had been answered. Power of prayer right there.
I guess so.
That's, yeah. Good, you know, that's probably good. I can't imagine if he would have died. That may have went to treason charges.
Yeah, you can only do this so many times before you're just done. It doesn't matter how hot you are, you will eventually find the hangman's noose or the executioner's axe.
Yeah, and this time the executioner's axe, they are not exactly kind, or be thrown down a well.
Yeah, that too. Final baptism.
Oh, in 496, Clovis was in the midst of a massive battle with the Alemanni tribe, and it was not going well. In fact, it looked like he was going to have a catastrophic defeat and maybe lose his own life. Legend goes, in the middle of battle, he made a deal with God that if God would help him destroy the Alemanni, he would convert. God came through, and Clovis won the battle. And so he held up his end of the bargain with God, and he told Clotilda about the battle and that he would convert to her brand of Roman Catholic Christianity. So pretty good stuff. I should say Chalcedonian Christianity. Still, yeah. Pretty good stuff. She had to be elated at that point. This was her mission, like from day one of their marriage, was to get this man to convert. It just took him to almost die in battle, and I can imagine like rolling your eyes like, God, such a man, you know.
Yeah, it's, all that prayer worked for something.
It did. Clovis was baptized on Christmas Day in 496, and in 497 Clotilda bore Clovis their third and last son, named Clothar the First. I should also mention that they have a son named Childebert the First, and I don't remember when he was born. He must have not been very important into her story.
I guess not.
But just so you know, that is a thing. They have three children. She gave birth to a daughter, also named Clotilda, to really confuse us history nerds. And
Clotilda the Second.
Yeah, and she watched her daughter get married off to Amalaric, who is king of the Visigoths, to hopefully solidify the peace between the two kingdoms. So you heard that right. You know the Visigoths that Clovis absolutely destroyed because of their Arians and their horrible, horrible, you know,
yep.
Heretics? He sent his daughter off to live with those horrible heretics.
Well, maybe that's why they married her off, right? Has the exact same name. They're like, just you watch. We're gonna be 2 for 2 on our sons getting sick, 2 for 2 on converting our husbands.
There you go. I like that one. She was honestly just a pawn in the game to solidify peace.
Yeah. Unfortunately. No, totally. No, she'll like convert them or something, and
yeah, we will. Yeah, we will learn about her when we do Amalaric, whenever we get to the Visigoths.
All right. We'll wait and see. We'll wait with bated breath.
Clovis ended up dying in 511. And to his infinite wisdom, the kingdom was split up into four, with her three sons and Clovis's legitimate child from another unknown wife named Teuderic. He is what we will do next week, or right, next episode. Clotilda now is Queen Dowager and Queen Mother, and she just lost all of her titles, her offices, her land. Women were not allowed to inherit anything, so that all went to her sons.
best hope your sons treat you well.
As you can imagine, she probably had a little bit of power over her sons and, you know, tried to wield or influence maybe and tried to wield that influence. They kept her living, you know, in decent luxury, I guess. But yeah. At some point, she moved out of the palace into the Abbey of St. Martin at Tours. She did not entirely withdraw from public life. In fact, Clotilda had enough influence to convince her sons to go to war against Sigismund, who was the son of Gundobad, the man who, you know, murdered her family.
Yeah.
So she's not entirely all saintly. During the war, Sigismund was deposed, imprisoned, and then executed. And to show Clotilda wasn't completely without pettiness, his body was thrown down a well to complete her vengeance against the already dead Gundobad.
Lovely.
Another lovely little, you know, family blood feud that...
Some poetic justice.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's poetic justice. What did Sigismund do?
He was the son of sins of the father.
That was definitely common.
Sins passing down is a Christian thing all the way. So
that is true.
This is just preaching right here.
That is very true. We're gonna have family conflicts that just extend generations down the line. Sigismund's heir, Godomar, retaliated and killed her son, Clotimer, in battle. So, you know, the one that she brought back to life. Yeah.
I think it'd be more fun if that was, like, the family feud throughout the generations. Like, everyone just keeps throwing each other down wells.
Yeah, that would be great.
I don't know what I know defenstration is throwing someone like out a window, but there's probably they need a word for throwing someone down a well.
I agree. Oh, I've never
defeated
heard of...
in battle, claim their body, and then throw it down a well. It also poisons the water source.
I was too, gonna say, so. What if you are, like, what if that's now your city and you need that water source?
You do it in like someone else's city. You can't do it very much.
Yeah.
You have a ceremonial well. So it doesn't actually have a water source. It's
just piles up with bodies.
Yeah.
After Clotimer's death, in Frankish fashion, her two remaining sons, Childebert I and Clothar I, came after Clotimer's children, who were under her protection, under Clotilda's protection, and because, you know, they wanted their land and power. Clotilda attempted to protect her grandchildren, but she helplessly watched in horror as her son Clotimer had her two grandchildren brutally stabbed and murdered in front of her after they refused to cut their hair and become a monk.
Mm.
Clotimer sent someone with a pair of scissors and a sword and said they get to choose.
And she couldn't have just been like, hey, you know, come to the monastery with you.
Yeah. So I can't imagine what that would be like to watch like your grandchildren be like brutally stabbed in front of you. That's Game of Thrones shit right there. That is such a scene right in like what House of Dragon, Game of Thrones textbook right there. One of her grandchildren, though, Clotoald, that is a horrible name to pronounce, Clotoald, and he actually decided to take the scissors. He was sent to the monastery and he became Saint Cloud, which is a pretty not popular name for cities, towns, and villages. I actually have been to St. Cloud in Wisconsin quite a bit. I have quite a bit of family that lives near there. So that's kind of cool. I didn't know that it came all the way back from the Merovingians.
Sounds like also that apparently sainthood is hereditary in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it is. I like it.
Two for two.
Well, as you can imagine, watching her grandchildren being stabbed in front of her completely broke Clotilda. She abandoned court life completely, and she threw herself into a life of prayer and service to the poor. Which, fair. Like, what else do you do at that point? Like, that would be absolutely horrific to live through. I can't imagine, like, a situation like that. The only thing you could do is, like, throw yourself into something to try and, you know, forget your grief.
Yeah. Or I guess, you know, be more petty and just, you know, really get into the public life.
Yeah. Yeah. She had two options, but that's not saintly behavior.
Yeah. And she's also, doesn't have the privilege of being a man during those times.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Those are correct.
So you're left with one choice.
I have a feeling if she had the privilege of being a man, this story would be completely different. And
yes,
history as absolutely. We know it.
Yeah.
Even granted, if it was just her.
Granted, though, it, you know, I guess if you wanted to play the hypotheticals, odds are she probably would have been tossed down a well long time ago.
Yeah.
Because having male heirs around is a lot different than female heirs.
That is true.
So yeah. her story may have never happened if the genders were reversed.
That is true. Yeah.
The fun what ifs.
Well, she wouldn't have been tossed on the well. Her mom was tossed on the well. Her dad was just stabbed, I think.
Well, that's I'm saying she wouldn't, that wouldn't have made it out at all.
Yeah.
Because leaving male heirs is a no-no.
Oh yeah, that's a no-no. No. That's honestly, that's stupid. I'm gonna call that is not something you do if you want to live long in medieval period. Unfortunately, it's kill or be killed.
Well, apparently leaving the female heir alive, or heir. Yeah, leaving the female relative apparently was a bad bite either. It wasn't a good idea either.
Yeah, it didn't really work out for him.
Yeah. Yep. She really did find the right husband to match her agendas.
Yeah, she did. And sometime later, she finds out that these two sons who, you know, came after her grandchildren were about to battle each other. And despite the horrific things they did, she was a mother and she loved her two sons. The story goes, Clotilda heard of this upcoming battle between her two sons. So she got on her knees and prayed at the tomb of St. Martin of Tours that the fighting cease. And her prayers were heard. A massive storm materialized right before the battle, preventing the armies from clashing in the field. Crisis averted.
Until the weather clears up.
Until the weather clears up. We'll find out. We'll find out what happens in the future. Once those fields dry. A month after she prevented the battle, after a very hard and a very sad life, I would imagine, she finally found peace and died at the tomb of St. Martin on June 3rd, 544. She was buried alongside her husband at a church they founded together named St. Peter and Paul that was later named St. Genevieve. And despite the church being destroyed later, their remains are protected underground to this day, undisturbed. I don't think it is actually known the exact location where their remains are, but it's just believed that they're there.
Yeah, no one's bothered digging it up, so
correct.
Yeah,
and there's no reason to, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Sometime after she passed away, she was venerated as a saint. Her feast day in France, for some reason, because they're the French, is in June 4th, but for the rest of the world, it is June 3rd when she died. So I wonder why the day difference. That'd be, if someone knows that, let us know, because that's odd.
It is bizarre.
And one of the prayers to her, because she is a saint, and, you know, the Catholics pray to saints, Saint Clotilda, you were the wife and mother who brought her husband and family to the faith and prayed for their conversion. Pray for us.
Amen. And
that's here you go. And that's what I have for Clotilda. It's kind of interesting. We came off a very brutal Clovis episode to kind of a more genteel wife that's this kind of sweet, sad story. Well, are you ready to rate her?
Yeah, we're going to give this new rating a try.
There we go.
Royal power.
All right, so for our non-regent monarchs, we're going to go, how much influence did you have with the king and kingdom as a whole? Or like the royal family?
Okay.
But first, how long do you think she was active as a queen consort and a queen dowager?
Oh. Was she considered queen dowager the rest of her life? I mean, she withdrew.
After she is queen dowager. Even if they didn't name her title, like, she's considered a queen dowager after her, you know, husband's
death.
King. Yeah, for the rest of her life. That's just kind of how it goes.
I mean, sounds like that she lived a good while, right? So, what? She's got to, I mean, I would guess, like, if you're talking lifespan, what? Like, give her, like, a good, like, 20 years?
For both?
I'd say, for both, probably like, it feels like she lived a long time. 30 years.
Well, she married to Clovis in 492. He died in 511. So she was queen consort for around 19 years. And then as queen dowager, she died in 545. And that was another 34 years. So if those dates are correct, her reign totaled up is 53 years.
Yeesh.
So I'm guessing she married Clovis around 12 teens. To 16 years. So she probably died in her late 60s, early 70s.
It's a very long life.
Yes.
Granted, she lived in a monastery, which is one of the safer places you could be.
That is true. But the fact that she came to that brutal Frankish court at like 12 to 16 years old and, you know, held her own, pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Positives. Let's be honest. She had a huge influence on Clovis getting to convert. Even if the exact story isn't true, I am very confident that she played a major role.
Yeah, for sure.
That he got her to convert. She was able to incite her sons to get revenge for her. Another thing. And, you know, even do it in style by throwing Sigismund down a well. And the negative is she couldn't do anything to protect her grandchildren. And I'm not going to go against her that she lost all her titles and stuff, because we're comparing them to
part of the course.
Yeah. They're, you know, their time or whatever.
Yeah.
The grandchildren part really are going to, I think, take her back, but she did really well. I mean, getting Clovis to convert, that's pretty massive. And that was a huge influence on the entire kingdom, because that created the conversion of the entire kingdom. That was like the forced conversion of the Franks.
I mean, I feel like this is like an 8.
I'm going to go a 7. I think the fact that she couldn't do anything to protect her grandchildren really kind of knocked it back. But
yeah, just kind of depends on, because you lose an awful lot when your husband dies. So
you unfortunately do. Yep, you do lose quite a bit of influence.
So we got a 8 and a 7 for a total of 15. Infamy.
All right, so for aggravating factors, the only thing I got is we're going to have to ding her naughty naughty on the whole Sigismund nonsense. Other than that, she was very saintly overall. I mean, crying out loud, she became a saint.
All right, so 1.
1, yeah.
So total of 2. Easy. All right. Fun one. Religious passion.
I mean, really, let's be honest. Clovis doesn't get a 10 rating on, you know, Christianity on religious passion without her. I think full marks 10.
And she's a saint, for God's sake.
Yep.
You know, you don't get to be saint without some passion and apparently, you know, converting people, saving babies, and stopping wars, or at least battles. 10 and 10 for 20. Stability.
Alrighty, so in this category, we can't really do stability of the kingdom. That's like a king's job. I'm going to say this is more of a how stable is their standing with the royal household as a total, or the king, if they're like married to him. Sorry. In this category, and I'm assuming no record of this, is that their relationship, like I said, was pretty stable. They did a lot of religious things together, and they were buried side by side. I don't think he was buried with the rest of his wives. So she had to be, if not he actually did spurn the rest of his wives, I don't think he did, but she was at least top wife. So she had to be pretty, really good relationship with the royal household. She was a dutiful, submissive wife, but she had a backbone when it came to religion. The only negative, again, she didn't have the greatest of relationships with her sons after, you know, they murdered her grandchildren.
Yeah. I feel like this is just like a four, because
I agree.
You kind of have to count when she's married to the king more than time after, I feel.
I do. Yep, I fully agree.
All right. 4 and 4 for 8. Royal demise.
She died after a long, hard life, naturally, but it is said she predicted her death, and I'm going to give her 1 point for that, because
all right,
that's the saint thing to do, is to predict your death. It is in so many stories.
I'm going to die someday. I'm just going to give her a 0.
All right.
1 point total. All right. Legacy.
All right. For the dynasty aspect, it takes 2 to establish a dynasty. She helped Clovis establish the powerful Merovingian dynasty that will rule the Franks over, that ruled the Franks for over 200 years. She bore Clovis 4 sons and 1 daughter. As of her death, only Childebert I and Clothar remained. One of those sons would go on to unite the kingdom again and become king of all the Franks.
Okay. Maybe they'll let go of that even splitting the land nonsense.
We can only hope. She is a massive, absolutely massive reason for the conversion of the Franks to Nicene Christianity, which we went over in detail in Clovis's episode, the implications and history for this. I mean, this alone is just massive points.
What kind of Christianity was it called again?
Chalcedonian.
Chalcedonian.
Chalcedonian, because we're past the date of, what did I say, 450 something?
Yes.
Let me look here. Chalcedonian. 451. The Council of Chalcedon was in 451.
We'll have to get used to saying it like that.
Yeah, I agree.
We'll have to get used to saying it like that. Chalcedonian.
Except for when we go out east, then we'll have to do other fancy things. But currently out west, yes, it is Chalcedonian.
All right.
It is said her relics survived the French Revolution, which is not normal, and are held in the Church of St. Lou, St. Gillis, in the Reliquary Chapel. And fun fact, this chapel is in Assassin's Creed Unity. I've never played that game, but that's
it was not a fan favorite. After like 3 or so, the fan base kind of started to not appreciate them as much.
The only thing I remember about Assassin's Creed was everyone liked Black Flag.
I loved it. It was great. I played 1 and 2, and I'm trying to remember. Unity was a later one, if I remember. maybe I'm thinking of.
We were,
yeah,
because
it was like 1, 2 Revelations, 3 Black Flag. Unity was, yeah, Unity would have been like 2015 or something like that. So yeah, not a fan favorite.
She later would become the patron saint of brides and parents of difficult children. I love that last little bit.
She definitely had difficult children.
Yeah, she did. Images are especially popular of her praying at St. Martin. And for some absolute nonsense, because I love obscure nonsense, there's an Italian seafood Mediterranean restaurant in Rome, Italy, named Clotilda. It's got $4 signs, so that's probably a pretty pricey restaurant if you're in Rome. Out of 284 reviews, it has 4.5 stars on TripAdvisor, and food and service is 4.5 stars, but the value is only 4 stars.
Gasp.
I know. If anyone's been there, let us know how it was. But I thought that was fun. I love little obscure nonsense like that.
It'd be like the wafers were horrible. You serve wafers and wine.
I love it. That's amazing. Alrighty, all right. Scott. How many points?
How about
before we?
Yeah,
alrighty, how much are you gonna give her on Legacy?
Feels pretty strong, but not quite. Oh, I don't know. I mean, gosh, it's always hard to rate based on the fact that, you know, the husbands are the one who get all the credit. Give it a 9.
I agree with you. I'm only going to give her 9 points. There's something holding back, and I don't know what it is.
Yep. So for giving ourselves medium vibes, a 9, a 9 for 18. That leads for us to give though slightly differing opinions, a total of 32 and 32 for 64.
Not bad. Pretty good. Now, is she excited? Is she powerful enough, religious enough, and leave enough of an impact in Europe that she should be given the title of Hand of the King, or is she kind of mediocre and just kick her out of the king's council, or is she so bad that we need to exile her out of the kingdom?
I gotta hand it to her. She's pretty good.
Yeah, I agree. I think we should give her Hand of the King.
So yeah,
all
pretty
right,
pretty solid person, has some beautiful artwork about them apparently, because sainthood will do that to you.
And she's the mother of the Merovingian dynasty. I mean,
and probably the one of the very strong reasons that Catholicism spread the way it did in France.
I would have to agree. Yeah. So congratulations, Clotilda. You are given the title of Hand of the King, given the badge, lead the King's Council. Alrighty. With that out of the way, that brings us to the end of Clotilda. Let us know what you thought of her. I personally enjoyed her. I think Scott did. We'd love to hear from you, the listener. You can message us on you can catch us on Messenger on Facebook or Instagram at Quest for Power, or email us at questforpowerpod@gmail.com. If you would like to start your own quest for power and become a lord, lady, or noble in your own right, you can do so at patreon.com/questforpower. And if you don't really want to do that, but you want to buy us a drink, I personally like whiskey. Scott, what do you seem to like?
Vodka.
Vodka. Scott's a good old-fashioned Russian, likes his vodka. Yeah, or just earn some extra karma. You can do that as well. Both links we'll put in the show notes. And if you don't wish to support us monetarily, a review would go a long way on any podcasting website. Give us 5 stars. Doesn't really matter what you say. Say something ridiculous like "All hail Saint Clotilda," and throw like a little culty vibe on there. Confuse people. Next week, We are truly beginning the Game of Thrones that is the Merovingian dynasty that makes the Targaryens look stable. Again, this means nothing to Scott, but I'm sure some of you this will mean things to. Our next monarch is going to be Clovis's first son, Theuderic I. And with that, until next time, the queen is dead.
Long live the king!